Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
Each time I see a little girl of 5 or 6 or 7, I can't resist the joyous urge to smile and say thank heaven for little girls.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this hour, Thank Heaven for Little Girls, a look at a program in Texas for keeping the wide-eyed dreams of young people, especially girls, alive, so that they can be killer app entrepreneurs by the time they grow up. Also, we'll have a look at some very big financial returns in a business where you never hear the words killer app, but you do hear the words double wide a lot. We'll explain later this hour. Also, a conversation about the pain and tragedy in South Korea in the wake of the ferry disaster and the rescue efforts that are continuing. But we begin with diplomacy. After weeks of confrontations, annexations, and outraged rhetoric in the UN Security Council over the crisis between Russia and Ukraine, four-way negotiations are underway in Geneva today. Officials from the United States, Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union. They're the first talks between the four parties since the political crisis began. The talks take place as a Ukrainian military mission to repulse pro-Kremlin militants in eastern Ukraine has apparently stalled amidst casualties, including the reported death of 3 pro-Russian protesters. Also part of the backdrop to these talks, Russian troops have been mobilized on the Ukrainian border in recent days. Joining me now, Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist and author of The New Cold War. Welcome, Ed.
Hello, John.
So let's begin with what Russian President Vladimir Putin said on television today. He has the authority to deploy military force in the conflict if needed. He referred to the eastern part of Ukraine as, quote, New Russia, and made this comment. Only God knows, he said, why it became a part of Ukraine. Is he speaking only to a domestic audience there, or is that message going to make its way to Geneva?
This is clearly not a message for a domestic audience alone. Certainly Russians are thrilled by what's going on in Ukraine. They feel this is the end of a period of humiliation that started with the collapse of the Soviet Union. And the Kremlin propaganda machine has quite successfully stoked a kind of nationalist frenzy inside Russia, where the people who run Ukraine are portrayed as fascists and nationalists and so on, which is really quite unfair. And it's all portrayed as part of a Western plot. But I think that the really significant thing to me was this use of Novorossiya, New Russia, which is an old colonial era term from the time when these lands were first conquered by the Tsarist Empire. And that isn't just eastern Ukraine. That stretches along the south coast past Odessa, right up to part of Moldova, the province of Transnistria. And so I find that very sinister. And I also find sinister the way in which he says that Russia has a right to go into Ukraine if it wants. Countries don't have rights to go into other countries' territory unless they have a Security Council resolution or unless there's some grave humanitarian catastrophe or emergency, and that's not happening. But Mr. Putin is doing his best to make it happen.
He seems to have been successful, though, in portraying that Russia has a much higher stake in the outcome here than the EU or the United States. I mean, he's mobilized troops, he's got the hearts and minds of the Russians behind him, and the West answers this with some sanctions, and, you know, there's no appetite for a military confrontation with Russia as far as the American domestic audience is concerned. He's called the bluff here, Putin has.
Yes, I think he has, at least in this round. And I think that it's absolutely preposterous for anyone to maintain that Russia actually cares about these Russians, these ethnic Russians in other countries. He's shown no interest in them over the 15 years he's been in power, except as a kind of stage army, which he can call on as an example of grievance and oppression. But there's no real sympathy or sentiment for them. But I think you're absolutely right, John, that he sees weakness. He sees a gap between deeds and words in the West, that we talk about a rule-based international order and about the importance of maintaining countries' sovereignty and borders and so on. But we are not willing to accept economic pain, and we're not willing to threaten the use of force. And so long as we are not willing to do either of those, and he's willing to do both of them, he's got the upper hand, and he's calling our bluff in a way that I find terrifying. I think we're heading for a really unpleasant confrontation.
Speaking with Edward Lucas, senior editor at The Economist, author of The New Cold War, is the new Cold War essentially dealing with what could happen over the next year or so, and that is economically what remains of Ukraine that's not pro-Russian will become more economically dependent upon Europe, and the EU will, and the United States will simply have to bail out this economic basket case on the eastern border.
I think you can't really bail something out if it's completely leaking and waterlogged. And the danger we're going to have is of a rump Ukraine, maybe landlocked, deprived of its eastern and southern regions, its heavy industry, which will be a very embittered and not really functional state. And that will be a problem, I suspect, chiefly for the European Union, although clearly the United States will have an interest in it as well. But on this business with the new Cold War, I actually coined the term back in 2007 and wrote a book then called The New Cold War Warning, that exactly this was going to happen, that Russia's economic influence in the West was going up, that its desire to meddle in its neighbours was unabated, and that sooner or later we were going to find we wanted to push back hard against Russia, and we were unable to do it because the economic pain would be too great. And I'm now, as you say, reissuing that book with a kind of I told you so introduction, because I'm afraid exactly what I gave warning of has actually come to pass. We are in a really difficult position here, and the whole post-war security order, which has made us here in Europe and you in America and everyone else feeling more or less safe and free, is being challenged by what's essentially a rogue state that has no interest in this post-war order and thinks it's totally unfair.
I'm dying to ask you this. We've asked a lot of historians over the past several weeks and months if, beyond the Cold War, if this is a new 1914 in the sense that you've got a potential for a refugee crisis in Ukraine, populations on the move, annexations, just like the Austrian annexation of Bosnia-Herzegovina, which raises the tensions in the region. This is 1914 all over again as well in some terrifying way.
Yes, I think you're right. And there are elements of 1914 and of all the miscalculations that were involved there. And you've also got elements of the late 1930s with this, as it were, the Anschluss of Crimea, which recalls the Anschluss of Austria, very popular among Austrians, very popular among Crimeans now. And this idea of the gathering of the Russian lands, to use a very sinister phrase the Kremlin uses, which is rather like Hitler's approach to the ethnic Germans who were the Volksdeutsch, who were left outside Germany's borders by the Treaty of Versailles. And then you've also got the kind of ideological competition of the Cold War, Mr. Putin very clearly now articulating a different version of civilization based on autocracy, the Orthodox Church, Russia's sort of historical destiny, something that I think Western commentators are rather underestimated. They assume that because Russia was capitalist, it was basically like us. Well, no, it isn't. And Putin is exactly showing that now. So we have three different historical precedents all combined. And boy, do we not know how to deal with it.
Well, I suppose it's tempting to look at this in apocalyptic, 1914 terms, Cold War terms. But let's take the other view. I mean, what can be accomplished at these talks? I mean, there is a chance that this could be a constructive attempt to really resolve this crisis. What do you think?
Well, John, I just disagree with that. I think Russia's very good at using diplomatic process as a way of tying us up in knots, because we are basically kind of very reasonable people. And if we have a problem and someone says, well, let's talk about this, we're inclined to think, well, that must be a good thing. But in Russia's case, it's not. If you look back at the way Russia does these things, they use talks as a kind of distraction, as a kind of camouflage while they create facts on the ground. And that's what they're doing right now. So my expectations of these talks are extremely modest. I think now's the time for us to be putting very tough sanctions on Russia, which the United States has done a good job, but only an initial good job. And there's a lot more we can do. We should be putting visa bans on. We should be freezing assets. We should be launching money laundering investigations. And we should be trying to cut off Russian energy companies' access to the world financial system and really raising the cost of doing business, Mr. Putin. Because at the moment, he just does not think we're serious. And so long as he thinks that, he's going to continue. And that's when we get the apocalypse, because my great fear is that he tries something in the Baltic states. And then very late in the day, we try and stop him. And we then have a choice between either the end of NATO or risking World War III. And that's a choice I'd much rather we never have to face.
Well, Edward Lucas, I tried to go optimistic on you, but boy, that was pretty futile there. You meet my pessimism with apocalyptic language. What levers does Putin have if the U.S. does, as you suggest, and the West does, as you suggest, raise the pain level for Moscow?
Well, he can do a number of things. He can withdraw cooperation on Afghanistan, but that's not great for him because he doesn't want the Taliban to win in Afghanistan. He can do more saber-rattling. He put his nuclear forces on alert. He can spook our populations by saying, are you really willing to die for Kiev? Are you really willing to risk nuclear obliteration for the eastern Estonian town of Narva? He can apply economic pressure to Europe. Now, in the very short term, Europe's got plenty of natural gas, and so they're in pretty good position. It was a mild winter. We've got plenty in store. As next winter approaches, Europe becomes more and more dependent on Russian imports. So that's one pressure point he's got.
Edward Lucas is the senior editor at The Economist. His book, The New Cold War, is being reissued with a new introduction. Do the words "I told you so" actually appear in that introduction, Edward?
I was very tempted, but I think it's better for other people to say that.
Thank you for that. Edward Lucas, thanks so much.
Bye-bye. It was a pleasure being on the program.
Later this hour, we'll meet 6-year-old Isabel Mendler from San Antonio, who has a dream.
I like to start, duct tape businesses, so, you can make stuff out of duct tape, and, you can make purses out of duct tape, too.
A duct tape business. Go for it, Isabel. Don't end up with regrets later on when you grow up.
This is Ruth in Austin, Texas. I always thought I'd make the best brownies in the world, and it'd be a great business, but I'm a bit of a security junkie, and the thought of not having a regular income, not having insurance and all that stuff kept me in the corporate world until I retired last year. Now I fantasize a little bit about that brownie business, but I'm just not sure.
This is Alina from Seattle. And yes, I have fulfilled my dream twice. I've owned 2 cafes with an emphasis on the word owned. It was some of the hardest work I've ever done in my life. Not that it didn't have its rewards. I miss the joy of feeding people, sometimes dreadfully, but I'm really glad I'm no longer in the business.
Some cautionary tales from some of you out there, but don't rain on little Isabel's duct tape business parade. I mean, Lucy from Peanuts did okay with her low overhead advice for a nickel startup, right?
All right now, what seems to be your trouble?
I feel depressed. I know I should be happy, but I'm not.
Well, as they say on TV, the mere fact that you realize you need help indicates that you are not too far gone. I think we better pinpoint your fears. If we can find out what you're afraid of, we can label it.
Ka-ching goes Lucy, hey? Later this hour, more from 6-year-old entrepreneur in training, Isabel Mendler. What's your startup? Seattle, Washington. I always wanted to start a design firm, which I did. I stopped because a good designer isn't the same thing as a good businessman. Boy, my dad learned that one the hard way. And here's one more.
This is Dr. Rebecca Provorst calling from Portland, Oregon. When I was 5 years old, I was in love with the ice cream truck. I was, however, a bit unsatisfied with the selection of ice cream, and so I wanted to open my own ice cream business, delivering choice ice cream around the neighborhood. As it turned out, I went to medical school, and I opened my dream business, which is an integrative medical practice, and I am pleased to not be listening to Pop Goes the Weasel all day long.
Ice cream truck, integrated medical practice, ice cream truck, integrated medical practice. What's the difference? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us your startup duct tape business is taken. You heard it here.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
South Korea is a nation in pain today, hoping not to become a nation in mourning. Rescue efforts for the 475 passengers and crew that were aboard the Sewol ferry that sank yesterday, trapping hundreds, continue. On board were mostly teenagers on a school trip to the holiday island of Jeju. South Korean Navy and some private divers have been searching the waters. The cause of the accident is still unknown, but it was reportedly traveling outside its normal sea route to save time and may have hit something underwater. Joining me now, reporter Stephen Borowick, who's covering the story for the Los Angeles Times from Seoul. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Explain how this has really drawn the entire nation of South Korea into the moment-by-moment tragedy that's unfolding there in the waters.
I think it's just the sheer magnitude of just how many young lives appear to be hanging in the balance here. And South Korea is just generally a tightly knit kind of society. It's famous for being ethnically homogenous. So a lot of people feel like a strong sense of connection to each other. It's a very wired country, so everybody's always tuned into what's going on. Almost everybody has smartphones, or at the very least, there's always television and newspapers. So I think it's just the unexpectedness of the catastrophe. And I think as the days go along, I think a little bit of a changing of the narrative, things that are coming out now are, it seems as though this was a very preventable tragedy. And obviously we're only speculating, but there is a fair amount of reason to believe that it was pretty preventable human error that was behind this. And I think over the next couple of days, as the emotional shock wears off a bit and we dig into things a bit further, some unpleasant aspects of it are going to come out.
All right, we'll talk about that in a moment, but you alluded to the homogeneity of South Korean sort of national culture and how wired the country is. I mean, part of just what's been heartbreaking about how this has unfolded is the reporting of messages from inside the ship from young people who are huddled in a location that you can get a visual picture of, but you really don't know. But it's like nothing I've ever seen before.
Yeah, well, in a story that I filed for the LA Times yesterday, I mentioned one image that was really widely distributed of a young person talking to his or her mom and saying in Korean, of course, "I think this will be the last time that I ever get to tell you I love you." And the mother responding, and then the conversation just kind of ending. And, you know, a viewer can only be left to assume that, you know, that young person is probably not going to be sending any more text messages anytime soon.
And the extent to which these people are known to be in pockets, is there any real understanding of where these people are? That ship, you know, went over very, very quickly. There must have been injuries from people falling and basically unable to even stand in the early moments. What's going on inside that ship? Did the authorities even know?
I don't think so. A big diving operation was mobilized, but the ship happened to go down in a place in an area of sea that has really strong currents. And so those currents have made it really, really difficult for divers to go underwater and to get access to the ship. Another thing that the strong currents are doing is kicking up a lot of mud, which is making visibility very limited. And so at this point, even though there were a lot of professionals down there today trying their best to get access to it and figure out what they could, it seems like very little was accomplished. And that's in a lot of ways made things worse. There's a lot of very distraught parents who are down there who are desperate for any kind of information. And right now the authorities just don't have a lot to tell them.
What are the connections between most South Korean citizens and the ferry system, the elaborate ferry system? Most people actually rely on the ferries. It's not a fringe experience for people in South Korea. It's a widely used system.
It is. I mean, South Korea is a rocky peninsula that's surrounded by a number of small and scenic islands. Jeju would be the biggest of them. It's the most famous island vacation destination in South Korea. In recent years, it's become very popular with visitors from China and Japan and elsewhere. But what these kids were doing, and all passengers on that boat, is something that's very, very typical of catching a ferry and heading out to an island for some fun. And it's, you know, very sad that such a trip has ended in this way.
What is the speculation on foul play here, negligence, a human error that you alluded to earlier?
I did a very interesting interview with a university professor, and he is convinced that they were traveling too fast in a more crowded area because they were running low on time. They first issued distress signals at about 9 a.m., but early in the morning, this professor I spoke to thinks that this area would have had a lot of fishing boats in it, and visibility was low. And so he thinks that what happened was the ship swerved suddenly to avoid a ship, another smaller ship, and that caused all of the cargo that's in the hull to not fall over on its side, which is what would be behind the ship lurching and eventually capsizing completely.
So it's not an actual breach of the hull. It would be a huge imbalance of the cargo that would just make it top-heavy and tip it over.
That's right. And this ship was built in 1994, and it was purchased by the South Korean company that operates it now in 2012. And when they bought it, they refurbished it. They added a big section on the back in order to increase its capacity. And what that would have done effectively is raise its center of gravity and make it more vulnerable to perhaps tipping over if there was an internal shift of weight like what might have occurred yesterday.
Stephen Borowick, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, reporting on the ferry tragedy in Seoul, South Korea. Thank you, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I want to share some more startup ideas and dreams from you out there. Portland, Oregon, I always dreamed of starting an auto repair shop and have. I dreamed of starting a bed and breakfast so that after I retired from auto repair, I would have some income since owning my own business will afford me no pension. I now have a very popular bed and breakfast. My wife runs it while I'm at work. Elizabethtown, Kentucky. My own comic shop was never able to start. It did a bit of online selling, but the demand has declined over the years, sadly.
Worst episode ever.
Florida. I've always dreamed of starting a nutrition consulting business. I tried years ago, couldn't get it off the ground because of finances or lack thereof. I'm thinking of trying again this year, this time with a partner. And George from Plano, Texas, is dead serious about starting a spycraft academy to organize escapist adventures that also teach skills like card playing, marksmanship, and flirting. I've been building a network of instructors, actors, promoters, etc. I don't have the funds to invest in equipment yet. I've been entering small business contests and applying for grants like crazy, though. Go for it, George. And, hey, folks, lay off. That's George's idea, right? 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Send us a tweet with your dreams at The Takeaway. Some of the most prominent Latino activists, frustrated with U.S. congressional inaction on immigration reform and President Obama's border policies, have taken to calling the president a name.
I believe that he does not want to go down in history as deporter-in-chief. That's not where he wants to be.
Deporter-in-chief, that's Democratic Congressman from Illinois Luis Gutierrez on this program last week, referencing the name the president has been given for his aggressive deportation policies. Nearly 2 million immigrants deported. The Justice Department, though, has registered its discomfort over this criticism by releasing some new statistics that show how judges have actually stood in the way of deportations in recent years and that the pace of deportation has actually slowed. We're joined by Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Fernando, welcome back.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
So did you see this story in the New York Times on the Justice Department statistics? And what do you think the motives of DOJ are at this point?
It's an interesting story. There are interesting facts here. However, we need to look at this from the, well, going back maybe to June 2011, when the administration took an administrative step, redefining prosecutorial discretion, basically telling federal agencies to go after mostly undocumented or people who are here unlawfully who have committed crimes. So basically, the administration is highlighting the fact that that was a big change in their policy. However, immigration activists say many people, still a large percentage of people who get deported today, approximately 1,000 a day, still do not have criminal records that are worthy of deportations. That said, as well, the total number of deportations, John, has dropped by 10% in fiscal year 2013, 368,000 in fiscal year 2013 compared to 409,000 in the fiscal year 2012. But still, President Obama, because this is all about perceptions, President Obama still has deported more people, according to its own government's figures, more people than any other president during its term.
So the perception is really not going to be positive for the president at this point, despite a 10% decline. And the Justice Department even admits in these statistics that much of that decline is due to the fact that, defendants are hiring lawyers and are much more aggressively defending themselves than was the case a few years back.
There is a backlog of immigration cases. That's right. Immigrant activists are bringing lawyers. The immigrant families themselves are preparing themselves more for deportations because people are prepared or scared of the current state of affairs when it comes to deportations.
Do you think that this policy and this deporter-in-chief name, which despite these statistics is probably going to stick straight up until the 2016 election, is going to deny the Democrats political advantage over its approach to immigration and, what would be a issue to run on with the Republicans? Because, in some ways, the Obama administration has kind of handed an issue to Republicans.
Well, let's say what conservatives say in general first. Conservatives argue that the president or this administration has not deported enough people, or it's not enforcing its laws, or on the opposite, they are inflating their deportation numbers. Immigration activists, on the other hand, are complaining, and as you said and as you quoted, they're calling President Obama deporter-in-chief. Now, this reputation could stick if there is no action either in Congress or by the administration. Let's remember that President Obama a few days ago ordered DHS Secretary Jay Johnson to review its deportation policies to make them more humane. However, just this week, President Obama said that he will take no administrative action on immigration, waiting for a window to still be open in Congress, for Congress specifically in the House of Representatives, to pass immigration reform. So if nothing happens between now and November, and then we go to 2016, which is very likely if nothing actually happens this year, that reputation of deporter-in-chief could stick for a long time, John.
Fernando Pizarro, Washington correspondent for Univision. Thank you so much, Fernando.
Thanks, John.
And now a story about history and who it belongs to, the shared history of what Rosa Parks did back in 1955 when she refused to give up her seat on a bus in Alabama, helped launch the Montgomery bus boycott. It's an event that forms one of the pillars of the civil rights movement. Parks was already a legend by the time she received an Essence Award back in 1993.
It's a long way from the suffering that we endured in Alabama, but for some reason, I had the faith and I prayed that we would one day not have to be insulted, mistreated, and sometimes physically hurt and often killed because we just wanted to be free people.
Parks speaking in 1993. She died in 2005 at the age of 92, but a dispute among her family members about the monetary value of her personal effects, some of which are historical treasures, has locked them away in a warehouse out of view. Attorney Stephen Cohen represents Elaine Steele, a longtime friend of Rosa Parks, and he also represents the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development in Detroit. Welcome, Mr. Cohen.
Hi, John.
So your client, Elaine Steele, is the co-founder of that institute. What is the institute's interest in the effects of Rosa Parks?
Well, the institute was begun back in 1987 by Mrs. Parks and Mrs. Steele, and it was a way to get involved in civil rights activities on a local level.
And was Rosa Parks' preference upon her death that her personal effects go to the institute?
Yes, in a manner, John. When she died, she had a very detailed estate plan, and she designated all of her personal effects to Mrs. Steele, and she designated the rest of her estate to her institute. Interestingly, John, these artifacts that are locked away in a New York warehouse were not part of Mrs. Parks' estate when she died. She had already given those artifacts to the institute years before, and the institute used these artifacts in its programming. So the public had access to these artifacts back in the 1990s.
What kinds of things are we talking about here? What sorts of treasures or things that would qualify as historical treasures?
It's a treasure trove of civil rights artifacts. It includes a congressional gold medal that Mrs. Parks received, Presidential Medal of Freedom. There are numerous photographs with other civil rights leaders. There are letters to and from Mrs. Parks and other civil rights leaders. So it shows a firsthand connection with the civil rights era.
Now, the family members who have caused this to go into probate here basically are looking for tangible value here. They basically want what happened to the King archives that were bid upon by the city of Atlanta, and the family shared something on the order of $14 million. So what is the family looking for here?
Well, Mrs. Parks and her husband never had any children. She did have a number of nieces and nephews, so she didn't leave anything in her will to her nieces and nephews. Frankly, she didn't have much to leave. She had a very modest, small estate. The Institute and Mrs. Steele have had their differences with the nieces and nephews, but I don't want to overstate it. The nieces and nephews did institute a will and trust contest after Mrs. Parks died. That contest was settled. The real problem here is a probate judge by the name of Freddie G. Burton Jr., who has unfairly managed the estate and controlled the estate.
With an asking price of $8 to $10 million, any chance somebody's going to write that kind of a check for this?
Well, we don't know. Nobody really knows what the value of these artifacts is. That's a number that's been bandied about. That didn't come from us. That came from, I believe, Guernsey's auction house.
How unseemly is all of this, given that this is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act being signed by LBJ?
It's horribly unseemly and completely unnecessary. You know, when a person takes the time to have an attorney draft up a detailed estate plan, it should be a no-brainer to put those wishes into effect.
Stephen Cohen, good luck.
Thank you so much, John.
Stephen Cohen is a lawyer for Elaine Steele, a longtime friend of Rosa Parks, who heads the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development, a foundation Parks co-founded in 1987 in the city of Detroit. Couple of business stories now. With the Fed keeping interest rates low and the stock market volatile and bubbling with risk these days, some investment bankers are sorely in need of easy money, like back in the good old 90s or even the past few years on Wall Street. Short of that $58 million windfall we learned about this week that you can get for being fired by Yahoo, that's the severance package for the CFO of Yahoo shown the door earlier this year. Short of that kind of easy money, where are the big returns? Two former investment bankers have figured out that if you really want the two-digit returns, you may have to lose the suit and put on some coveralls. Dan Weissman and Dave Schlachter are principals and co-founders of Jaffa Parks. It's not some exotic biotech startup or maker of iPad apps chasing the next Candy Crunch game, no. Jaffa owns cash-rich, reliable, but utterly unexotic mobile home parks in Indianapolis and across Texas. Trailers, it turns out, are not trash as an investment. Dan and Dave, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
What is the demand for mobile homes right now say about the housing industry, about poverty, about the real estate business right now?
Well, first of all, anytime we discuss poverty, it conjures images of exploitation, we feel. And to be fair, there are community owners who behave like slumlords. And the model works for them because it's usually cost prohibitive for residents to move their homes out of the community. So owners can kind of get away with murder, so to speak. For instance, in all the parks we've bought that have pools, the pools have been covered in green slime. And, I mean, it looks like the birthplace of the Swamp Thing or something. But we take a totally different approach. We found that by investing heavily in the communities, by reopening pools and refurbishing clubhouses, it results in residents, you know, really investing in their own home sites, caring about the communities. You know, it's just really a virtuous cycle that we feel like we can kind of kick off. Do we raise rents? Yes, but modestly and only after we make improvements.
Well, I'm not trying to characterize what you're doing as slumlording or exploitation, but it does seem as though there's a real interesting combination of events that spike the demand here. You've got restricted access to sites because zoning really limits the number of mobile home sites that can go up. So really, it's a whole lot of people looking for this as really their own only alternative. What sort of returns are you getting here or expecting?
Look, it's a good business. It's a good business from our perspective, from an investment perspective. So when you go into to a park and you look at a park that you're potentially going to buy, you look at what the income is in year one. But what we find is that actually when we purchase parks from those that have behaved like slumlords, that those are the best investments, not only for us, but also for the residents in the community. So when we come in and we become the owners of the park, we immediately reinvest in the community, reinvest in new roads, the pool, the clubhouse, basically give the community a facelift. And instantly, residents respond and show pride of ownership with their gardens and community events and things of this nature. So the feedback from them was, you know, resoundingly that the quality of life had gone up and they were pleased with living in a safe and secure and clean community. Was important to them.
How do you handle this by remote control? I mean, you guys are in San Francisco. Your properties are in Texas and Indianapolis and around the country. You know, you got people with squirrely credit scores and, you know, there's a rep for the kinds of things that go on in some mobile home parks. Right. I would think you'd have to be closer to the action here to really keep control of the situation.
Yeah. Well, we travel a lot. We're generally on the ground about a week out of every month. But despite seeking out an unsexy sector, we have set up our technology in the sexiest way possible, using all of the tools after we purchase a property. We immediately eliminate all cash transactions. We eliminate all paper from the office. Everything is scanned in. All the files go to a cloud system. And so we're able to monitor and control and oversee the operations of our managers on the ground. And that's an important point because whenever we buy a community, we must hire a couple. You generally speaking, it's a couple, and it's generally a man and a woman. And he, generally speaking, again, is the maintenance man, and she will run the office, collect rent, deal with the community events, resident relations. So we sort of, so to speak, have our eyes and ears on the ground and have the technology in place to manage them and the community.
How, do you think of this as a kind of development work in the way that you've had experience in places not in the United States of upgrading communities and community development?
Yeah, so I've worked a lot in developing countries. I lived in India for a year doing a consulting project for the Supreme Court of India and worked in a courthouse that had 200 judges and hundreds of thousands of people traveling through it every week. And one thing that, you know, I really took away was the importance of having good policy in place. And so really, as community owners in some of these communities, we have, you know, north of 600-700 people living in them. They're really like small towns, like small cities. And we're really like the government. And we put our own public policy in place. I guess you'd call it private policy. You know, just having rules and having consistent enforcement in a transparent way, you know, really helps these communities develop after we buy them.
I'm wondering if you guys are like, you know, at a party in wine country there in Sonoma and your cell phone goes off and you have to deal with, I know you have maintenance on the sites, but you have to deal with like somebody parked their monster truck on the neighbor's geraniums or septic goes out. I mean, is that the kind of thing that happens to you?
I would say that maybe 60 to 70% of our day is sort of like the Jerry Springer show. The property management issues that come up managing a mobile home park are colorful. And we love it, but it's certainly not for the faint of heart.
So
it can get a little hairy for sure. I mean, 2 hours after we closed our second deal, I was getting ready to go out and surf, and my phone rang. And it was the property manager, and she said, "Dave, you better go and check the news online. There's a full-scale SWAT team incursion unfolding in your new park. Kind of good luck with that." And they actually ended up, you know, they had a tank in there and guns and, you know, the full outfit. And they ended up arresting the guy who was later convicted of arson and murder in the biggest, you know, crime story of 2012 in Indiana. So those kind of things do happen. And this certainly is not for the faint of heart, but, you know, not all the issues are quite that serious.
So it's Sons of Anarchy meets Breaking Bad with a laugh track.
That's a good way of putting it.
Dave Schlachter is a principal and co-founder of Jaffa Parks. Dan Weissman, also principal and co-founder of Jaffa Parks. They are out in San Francisco, but their parks are across Indianapolis and the state of Texas. Dan and Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Little kids are wide-eyed optimists at age 5 and 6 until somehow we adults chain-yank their dreams, upload a bunch of rules into their fanciful little heads, and boom, our out-of-the-box thinkers become an army of preteen conformists. Well, biomedical engineer and nanotechnology wizard Krystal Glanchai, who's also a teacher, noticed this effect was particularly pronounced in young girls. And so as part of her entrepreneurship incubator company, Venture Lab, in San Antonio, Texas, she offers a week-long course called Girls Startup 101 that pushes 5 to 7-year-old girls to think about creating businesses that they would lead. We wanted to explore exactly how this works, and so we invited Crystal Glanchai and two of her satisfied clients to talk about all this, 6-year-old Isabel Mendler and her dad, Frederick. Glanchai says that Girl Startup 101 is more about planting seeds to prevent the unlearning that happens when girls grow up.
When I was teaching at the university level, I found that it was really hard for me to get a lot of students, and girls in particular, into the entrepreneurship program. And I found that a lot of the girls didn't have the confidence, and they were like, well, there's a lot of boys and guys in the industry, and we're just a little afraid. So my whole reason for kind of starting this is that myself personally, I have 2 daughters who are age 5, and I think that kids, even before they go to elementary school, need to learn that they can do anything. They can create, they can go into science, they can go into technology, and just having that confidence to believe that they can turn their ideas into products or services or even start companies before they get into school.
All right, Isabel, I'm just a journalist, you know, radio guy. I don't know anything about business or startups, really. What's the difference between starting a business and just having like a little lemonade stand or something like that? Isabel?
Well, you sort of can start your own business by like get some friends and start like sort of like practicing, and then you could start your own business.
And the kinds of businesses you would love to start, what are they?
I like to start like duct tape businesses, so like you can make stuff out of duct tape, and so you could like it would stick, and like you can make purses out of duct tape too.
You sure can. Isabel Mendler is a 6-year-old who has attended, Crystal, your girl startup twice, and Frederick Mendler, I noticed the same last name. You're a co-founder of this recruitment technology startup, TrueAbility. Why did you decide to get your daughter involved in Girl Startup 101?
I think 2 main reasons, and one being that as a co-founder of a startup, being an entrepreneur myself, it's actually tough to influence her in the things I want to, as far as I want to build independence and I want to teach her the things that I've only now learned in the, maybe the last 10 or 15 years of my life. But how do I do that? And how do I break it down to a way that she can understand it? And Girl Startup really did that. And I was skeptical at first about how you teach entrepreneurship to kids at such a young age. I mean, I still barely spell it correctly when I'm typing the word. So how do we get this concept down to that level? Coming out of the first week, they really did. I mean, it was just amazing to have her come home and talk about entrepreneurship and how she was brainstorming ideas and how they made products and they're going to sell them. And, you know, I was really proud. And those are the things I want her to learn at a young age, so they just become second nature for her in life.
So do you believe you can do anything, including start a business, Isabel?
I sort of was thinking mostly I could start my own business by selling cupcakes.
That's a good one. How would I know that they're your cupcakes?
Well, mostly sometimes you can just get like white frosting, and you can get like something like a berry or something, smush it, and you can like make colored other frosting.
That's pretty good. Crystal Glanchai, if the generation that you're teaching now at Girl Startup 101 were to make it to your college level course or the kinds of courses that you've taught to older women, what do you want them to have in their toolkit that you don't find them with now?
The main thing I want them to have is the confidence that they can go out and actually take an idea and turn it into a product by doing market research, talking with as many customers as possible, really validating their idea, creating a prototype, coming up with the business model, and then actually being able to present themselves and pitch confidently in front of investors. So it's kind of that whole entrepreneurial skill set.
Isabel, how many products and ideas have you pitched to somebody? Have you come up with and said, here's what I want to do?
Well, mostly I sold them to my mom and dad because sort of you can just like start your own business by sort of starting with your mom and dad.
That's great. A lot of people do that, you know. But in your case, if somebody says no to you, that's actually not a good idea. What do you do next, Isabel?
Then you can go find someone else who likes duct tape purses or stuff that is different.
So that's the key, Frederick. You know, don't take no for an answer. and have the ability to take a next step if you do encounter failure.
I think that's right. And the overall theme for me is about independence. You know, it's about her understanding that there's options and there's opportunities and that she doesn't always have to rely on other people. You know, as long as she understands that, that the future is hers to define and that resilience is there too, that, you know, one of the things about all this is to try something and fail and get back up and learn from that and continue on.
I just wanted to follow up on that fear of failure thing because I think that is really the critical piece. Whenever I teach the classes or any sort of classes, I tell the students up front, I actually expect you to fail. Entrepreneurship's not black or white. It's very gray. I can't tell you the right answers. You actually have to go out and do the research yourself.
What surprised you the most about what 5 to 7-year-old girls are capable of based on your experience so far?
The thing that I really like is they kind of haven't been educated out of their creativity just yet. So they're not afraid to say anything. They'll come up with the most amazing ideas. And we don't want to limit what their ideas are. So we'll just kind of work with them and try and make it so that it's a little bit more reasonable, something they can do in a week. To see them at the beginning, usually they come in, they're kind of shy. And then by that Friday, they are just excited and exuberant. Their parents are there. So it's just kind of watching that growth and how they become more confident themselves.
Frederick, do I have to sign a non-disclosure agreement to ask you about any great ideas that Isabel's come up with that, you know, I might
not yet,
really
not yet.
Be excited about?
What I like about it is that her ideas now aren't limited. Now, instead of, you know, I hope she gets married and lives happily ever after, it's, well, maybe she can work in my beignet shop in New Orleans or, you know, things like that.
Isabel, where did you come up with the idea of a beignet shop?
Well, I've been watching movies called The Princess and the Frog. She opens a store and it sells beignets.
And you think you could do that?
Uh-huh.
Do you think your dad would be a good partner, or are you looking around for maybe somebody who might be even better than he is?
I think I would go with my dad.
All right. Frederick and Isabel, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Crystal Glanchai, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Crystal Glanchai is the founder and CEO of Venture Lab in San Antonio, which offers a week-long course for 5 to 7-year-old girls called Girl Startup 101. Isabel Mendler has taken that course twice. She's a 6-year-old. And her dad, Frederick Mendler, is the founder of a recruitment technology startup called True Ability. Got a business dream you've been carrying with you since you were, you know, 6?
Hi, this is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. I have always wanted to own a bohemian used record store, a total beat poet hangout where people could sit around, listen to music, talk about music, spin vinyl, and just have a cool place to hang out.
Tell us your dream business. What's stopping you from starting it? We're not. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number, or leave a comment at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Kids will try to run you over. Kids will try to bring you down. Kids will never say they're sorry. Kids back then are older now.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Learn more at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com. TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.